Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
You are listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show brings the culture to horticulture. So, if you've been listening, we are doing a USDA series this year. And we are covering the zonal map of the United States with discussions of gardening per zone, which leads us to a larger panoramic shot of horticulture across America and the people that are involved with keeping it green for us humans, animals, and insects. So we're in zone 7.
Our zone.
Which was actually really hard to figure out what to focus on.
Yeah, because we talk about it
so much. Seven. And we also bag up so much garbage in New York City. Green garbage from all of our gardens. So today we're going to talk some trash and how horticulture has transformed trash into amazing parks for public enjoyment. Both of today's guests are in Zone 7 and two projects and designs that exemplify science and environmental progress. Fresh Kills is in Staten Island, New York, and we're going to speak with Dr. Kat Field. And then further south, Mount Trashmore in Virginia Beach, which is actually an earlier design that has proven wildly successful in the transformation of utility space into public space. So we're going to start with New York and the newer project, Fresh Kills, on the borough of Staten Island at the southernmost tip of the island, closest to the New Jersey coastline.
Let me tell you a little bit about Kat Field, because she has a very impressive resume.
Yeah.
and a very diverse resume. I found it really fascinating. Dr. Field is the manager of science and research development at Fresh Kills Park. She recruits, coordinates, and consults on park research projects conducted by government and academic researchers related to ecology and ecological restoration. To complement work by partners, she's developing the park team's internal research projects focusing on fish health and diversity, grassland management, and water quality monitoring. She has developed and managed on and off-site public programming relating to urban ecology at the park, such as lecture series, birding programs, environmental sustainability outreach, and biodiversity survey events. Additionally, she assembled a science advisory committee to identify research priorities and assist with positioning Fresh Kills Park as a leading site for ecological restoration research. Kate holds a BA in neuroscience and behavior from Vassar College, an MA in animal behavior and conservation from Hunter College, where she studied the sensory systems of cockroaches, and a PhD in biopsychology and behavioral neuroscience from CUNY, where her dissertation work focused on communication in electric fishes. Additionally, Kate is a U.S. Coast Guard licensed captain with a 100-ton master's license and has held a second career as a commercial sailing captain in New York Harbor for the past decade, contributing to her strong interest in the ecology and health of our local waterways. Now, that's impressive.
That is an amazing resume.
Kate, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for holding on to the line. I know we were running a little bit late today, and I appreciate you hanging in with us.
Happy to.
Okay. So tell us, how did you end up at Fresh Kills?
So when people kind of get out of the graduate school world, there's a few options, right? One of them is to stay in academia, and the other is to go elsewhere. These days, you hear a lot about the plight of adjuncts in that world, and,
right.
and I kind of knew that I didn't want to stay in that route.
Uh-huh.
And because I had been also working in the New York waterways for so long, I was really interested in just how I could work in New York City, stay in New York, and kind of start to interface with a lot of different types of research and ecology instead of just one type. And I had actually been to Fresh Kills Park, which I'll talk about, before, actually, as a boat captain. So I sort of knew the site and how interesting it was. So when the job popped up, I had to apply.
So tell us about the name Fresh Kills. If you're not a New York descendant and you don't understand what kills means, can you explain this?
Sounds strange.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. People always say, oh, it's such an unfortunate name.
I know.
Well, the word kill actually comes, it's Dutch, and it comes from the Dutch language and means stream. So there's actually a lot of kills like that in the region. We can even think of the Catskills or the Arthur Kill Waterway
uh-huh.
or the Kill Van Cull. Basically, if you just say stream instead, that's what we're talking about. So
right.
in this case, the Fresh Kills Waterway is a fresh stream.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the history of the site and how the idea to become a park evolved.
Sure. So the site was historically all tidal creeks and wetlands. And then in 1948, during a lot of building time in New York City, Robert Moses, who was then New York City's master planner,
mm-hmm.
Decided to turn that area into landfill. And the idea was actually just to fill it in for 3 years, so to make way for industrial and residential development. Of course, when you start to fill in area with New York City's garbage, it becomes a little hard to stop. We produce
yeah.
a lot of trash here in New York City.
Yeah.
And so that 3 years turned into 53 years. And at its peak, the Fresh Kills landfill was accepting 29,000 tons of trash per day. And it became the world's largest landfill during its time. And in the 90s, it actually started taking all of New York City's trash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
if
you were a Staten Island resident, you know, it didn't feel so good to be taking the entire city's waste. And there was a lot of public pressure to close down the landfill.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I lived on Staten Island for a number of years
mm-hmm.
in the 80s. And you could see, you could see it and smell it in the summertime.
Right.
Yeah, I always talk about having to, you know, drive by on the highway with my dad and, you know, try to roll up the windows before you got
to Yeah, it was bad. It was bad.
And you'd always forget until it was too late.
Right.
So there was a lot of pressure to close it. And then in the 90s, there was sort of a political alignment between the Staten Island Borough President, the mayor of New York City, and the governor of the state. And the decision was made to close it down.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2001, the Fresh Kills landfill accepted its last barge of garbage. It actually briefly reopened for a totally different purpose, which was the sorting of the debris from the World Trade Centers.
Yes, right. Yes.
And the New York City, sort of, you know, along with the Municipal Arts Society, decided to launch a design competition for a plan to turn the site into a park.
Right.
Yeah. So there's only so many things you can do with a closed landfill as far as development, because, you know, you can kind of think of, you're not going to build anything large on it because it's not completely solid ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was also to make it a space that the public could go, and especially those people who lived around the landfill for so many years and were burdened by it, to turn it into something that could be used by the community.
Yeah. So yeah. Carmen and I often go out. There's one in progress right now in Jamaica Bay. So as you drive eastward out on Long Island, you can see the
Pennsylvania
process.
Avenue.
Yeah,
Pennsylvania Avenue.
You can see the process of the plastic covering that goes over the garbage, and then you start to see plant remediation, and you start to see little grasses and trees. Tell us the early steps in the process.
Sure. So the process of sort of closing and turning it into a green space?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of infrastructure that goes into landfill closure. And it's, part of that is what you were just talking about with those that capping process, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And at Freshkills, we also collect some of the byproducts from the landfill. So the methane gas is collected, and it's actually purified at a plant on site. And it's sent back to the utility company to be used as heating and cooking and power gas.
Ah.
But when you do that, so basically when you put that big cap over these, you know, giant hills, you seal it so that the gas can be collected. And then you also, though, you prevent new ground rainwater from going in. And so for that reason, you can think of, you know, in Freshkill's case, about 1,200 acres of actual landfill area. The site itself is larger, but of capped area. That's a lot of rain that has to go somewhere. So
right.
That gets sent to holding ponds or detention basins.
Uh-huh.
So there's a whole freshwater ecosystem that develops. And then you also have the liquid that sort of starts to seep out of the garbage. We call that leachate. I kind of say it's like if you don't take out your kitchen trash for far too long and you get that sort of like gross brown liquid layer at the bottom.
That terrifies me, honestly.
So we have a lot more of that.
I get panicked when I see that.
Yeah. And that's collected and purified as well.
Okay.
Can I ask I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted, while I remember, I had a quick question. Is there settling? Like these are, you said it's not solid and you can't build on it and you cap it, but does it settle?
It does. It settles very slowly.
Okay.
You can't see it, you know, with the naked eye by any means, or feel it or moving around or anything like that. But you can tell with survey equipment that it slowly settles.
Okay. Interesting. I'm sorry. So continue. It's fascinating.
Sure. So you have that drainage layer that takes all of the rainwater, and on top of that, you know, and underneath the capping, you have the gas vent layer, which collects all that gas. And then you have some different layers of soils. And the very top one, which is a minimum of 6 inches, is planting soil. And on top of that go grasses, in our case native grasses, which are really planted, their primary purpose being just to hold that sediment so that as it rains, it doesn't wash away all of that capping material.
Right, right, right. So it's not like the sponge park idea of water flowing through the root system and cleaning. It's more a retaining system.
Yeah, and it does, I mean, the water does flow through those grasses and before it gets to some stormwater collection systems.
Right.
But it's not sort of the main purpose of the design.
Okay. So tell us, like, what plants work and what don't.
Yeah, so that's, we do a few different studies that look at that. So all of the mounds, we call them, the landfill mounds, are capped with native grasses. So those are all have been sourced, especially in recent years, from the Greenbelt Native Plant Center on Staten Island.
Hmm.
So it's a native mix, and one thing that we're looking at right now in particular is that we know these grasses grow well there, and they're species that we've known are, you know, local to the region, and they do succeed in the climate of Staten Island. But we're looking at what animals seem to like those grasses.
Right.
And the big thing for us right now is looking at grassland birds. So grassland birds are, you know, there's a variety of species of grassland birds, but one in particular that we've been studying is the grasshopper sparrow. It's a little bird. It kind of looks like a tennis ball with wings almost. just sort of a round little bird. that's seen an 85% decline in New York State since the 1980s. And this guy has taken up residence at Freshkills Park. And they don't just need, like, a football-sized field of grass to nest in. They need about 350 acres minimum of uninterrupted grasses. So they need a whole lot of space.
Yeah. No wonder they went away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you. Fascinating.
Yeah. So they've started nesting at Freshkills. We had about 60 of them a couple years ago, and they fledged a whole lot of young. We had fewer last year, and then this year we're still surveying to, you know, get a final number. But we noticed that they're all nesting in the eastern section of the park, which was actually the most recently capped, and that was in 2011. And they don't like the sections in capped in 1996 and 1997 as much. And they're capped with similar mixes of grasses, but basically the succession has gone to, you know, a more dense habitat in the more longer ago capped mounds. So we're looking at sort of how we can use these native grasses, but also maintain the aspects that seem to be beneficial for, in this case, a state-threatened species that we'd like to, you know, have keep coming back.
I have a question, Kate, about a species that recently has kind of exploded on Staten Island, as I discovered recently, deer.
Yeah.
Does that have, is that going to have an impact, you think, on the park and the wetlands there? Because
Well, the deer certainly have an impact, you know, I would say almost most strongly on our woodlands.
Yeah.
So they really, you know, they like to eat just all of the new vegetation in woodlands, any new trees that are trying to grow up.
Yeah.
We have an experimental forestry plot on the northern end of Freshkills Park, and we've had to put up some deer exclosure fencing just so we can keep those new trees from being able to get a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, Staten Island's really having to deal with the huge influx of deer, and you know, people, of course, people like deer. They're beautiful animals, but they can be really damaging, of course, to the plant life and then to other things as well, of course.
Can you tell us some more species that have generated due to park development?
Sure. So the grasshopper sparrow is certainly our star, with other bird species, we also have one of the largest sort of groups of ospreys on site, and that's not just from park development, but also just because the waterways and the region have gotten so much cleaner over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a lot of these things because it's an area that has so little human traffic at its current stage.
Right.
And also so little lights. You know, so there's really very little light pollution for New York City, at least, there.
Right.
And so we're really seeing, you know, things that, especially in the sort of larger mammal sense, that are a little scared off of other areas that like to hang out there. We see a lot of deer at Freshkills, but they are, of course, all over Staten Island as well.
Yeah.
And we see muskrats and
rabbits,
some other kind of fun things too.
Yeah. Do you have rabbits and beavers? And
there are rabbits. There aren't beavers, although there are some beavers on Staten Island.
Okay.
And I think there's actually two pairs now. But I had to confirm that. But
beavers?
It's a little exciting to see. There's also some up in the Bronx River.
Okay.
That's so exciting because New York City was founded on beaver pelts, essentially, initially. It's really amazing. And of course, this is not a new idea.
Right.
Right? I mean, Flushing Meadows, right? That was a landfill.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
A landfill.
Right.
That they did the World's Fair on. And now it's an amazing park.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, a huge park.
With huge park attendance.
Yeah.
And the horticulture is just incredible.
But Freshkills is going to be the biggest park in New York City. Am I right?
Actually, Pelham Bay Park will be bigger, but it is the biggest park developed in over 100 years in New York City, and it will be the biggest landfill to park project in the world.
Well, in New York, of course, we have to have the biggest,
right? Right,
because we have the most trash.
Exactly.
Well, I want to just talk a little bit about the future. What does the future hold for the park? I know right now, basically, it is closed to the public except for some very special tour days. But when do you think it's going to open, and what's the launch of that?
Sure. So the park is opening and being constructed in stages. It's a long timeline, and people always wonder why does it take so long, but full park construction is now estimated in 2036. But that being said, there's different projects opening along the way. So right now, we actually do have a few small open park projects. One is Shmuel Playground on the north end of the Presqu'ile Park. Another is a 3.2-mile bike and pedestrian greenway on the eastern edge. And then another is the Owl Hollow soccer fields on the south end. And in a very exciting now for us is that the first interior park project is going into construction imminently. So the first park project that's basically actually in the former landfill boundary. And that's a North Park ARC project, and it's a couple-mile bike and pedestrian path. There's going to be a bird overlook tower, a wetland observation tower, as well as a native seed farm, which will actually help to have the seeds and the plant life that will be used in other park projects in the future.
Yeah. That's what I love, is that Parks Department is doing this amazing job growing the plant material themselves. Now they're going to be seed saving. Yeah. You know, it just doesn't get any smarter and efficient than that.
Yeah, instead of just fencing it off and doing nothing with it. And it does take a long time. I mean, the Pennsylvania, the one that we drove by on the Bell Parkway, the Pennsylvania Avenue landfill.
Right.
I remember as a kid, garbage still going there.
Right.
You know, and it's not quite ready to be open to the public.
No.
And you know, last season we had Betsy Barlow Rogers on the show, and she talked about how we tended to dump our garbage in our wetlands, right?
Right.
Because it was on the fringes and edges of things.
Right.
Right.
Who knew the wetlands were going to be
were important.
Right. Well, it was an industrial city.
Yeah.
We didn't value them.
Yeah. Right. So now it's so great that, like, I, as a former Staten Island resident, and Staten Island does have a lot of green space compared to other boroughs, but to have a little bit of prairie kind of looking space on Staten Island is really, really exciting, I think.
Well, and, you know, on the last show last week, we talked with a seed saver, the head gardener down at Blackberry Farm in Tennessee.
Yes.
And here we are, going to do our own seed saving. And, you know, it doesn't get more efficient than that. And I'm just, it's very exciting to watch New York develop into a space that values recreational and environmental issues.
And we're going to try to get it, take a tour of it this summer. We always go on a field trip with our team.
I think we're going to be there August 17th.
Yeah. So maybe we'll meet up with you,
I would
Kate.
Love to meet up with you.
Yeah, excellent.
All right. We have to take a break now. Thank you, Kate, for joining us and for all of your work. And I want to talk separately and privately about your
boating
experience.
Captaining.
That's like a whole other world that you're involved in.
We'll talk offline about that. Thanks for being
on
the show.
Thanks for joining
Kate.
Us, and thanks for shedding some light on this great project.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And hey, if you want to go boating in Presqu'ile, July 23rd, we have a boat tour.
I know.
Oh,
I know you do.
All right.
Okay,
it
looks awesome. All right.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you. We're
going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to go further south and talk to Simsy Hauser in Virginia Beach about Mount Trashmore, also in Zone 7.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, welcome back to Weeding Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Alice and I are talking trash today.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
And we are, yes, and this trash has been turned to treasure. Our next guest...
Thanks to plants.
Yes. So our next guest is Simsy Hauser. Simsy is the operations coordinator for the City of Virginia Beach's Parks and Recreation Landscape Management Division. And one of her duties is managing the city's urban forest management plan, which involves community engagement and education, management of existing UTC, and periodic assessment. She has over 20 years of horticulture and sustainable landscape maintenance experience, and she believes that educating our youth to become champions for the environment is the most important thing she will ever do and is the most favorite task of her job. Simsy, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
So... let's talk a little bit. Let me just give a quick overview. Mount Trashmore Park is one of two signature parks within the Virginia Beach Park System. With its world-renowned reputation, this 165-acre park is the city's most well-known and most utilized park. It is the most visited park in the city, operating approximately 360 days a year. The park is open daily from 7:30 a.m. Until closing time. This does not include early openings and late closings due to city-sponsored events and permitted special events. So the signature park has many amenities, including but not limited to, there's two mountains, Trashmore and Encore, multi-use yep. asphalt trail, two playground systems, a water-wise garden, restroom facilities, a mobile vending operation, two lakes, Trashmore and Windsor, a skate park and a vert ramp, a special events area, and a drink and snack vending area. Now, I grew up in Arlington, Virginia as a kid, and I remember Mount Trashmore in 1979 because my brother went to skate the park. And I remember being interested in the environmental movement as a kid because I was watching DC just explode, and I was watching I-66 come in, you know, I was watching the metro like be built in Washington, and I remember how fascinating it was to learn that this park was developed on this landfill, and here I am speaking with you.
Yes, and I wasn't here back in the day, but I do know, just talking to some folks who've been here for a long time, they said that it was always planned that way, that they had that idea in mind when, you know, probably not long after they started working on building the actual trash mountain.
Oh, okay.
So they always had it in their mind that they wanted to eventually turn that into a park.
Oh, so it was conceived with the idea of a park.
Conceived, yes.
That's great.
Yes.
So how did you come to horticulture, and what's your professional path to Mount Trashmore?
I think my mom is the person that gave me the bug. I lived in Alaska, and she used to plant a vegetable and flower garden every year, and
uh-huh.
I think that's kind of where I got the bug,
uh-huh.
so to speak.
That's how it works, yeah.
Yeah, and then I started taking some horticulture classes actually late in life because I'd kind of lost my way,
uh-huh.
and I was like, okay, this is where, this is my passion, this is where I'm supposed to be, you just know it, and I haven't looked back since, and so I've been doing this for over 20 years now.
So you tell me about your horticulture training. Were you in the landscape end of things, or were you in the nursery end of things?
I actually went to community college, Tidewater Community College, here in Chesapeake, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Really my biggest education was getting a job at the Norfolk Botanical Garden. And there I worked and learned the bulk of everything I know, not just about horticulture, but about landscape maintenance and, you know, how to really take care of ground the right way. And it just, that was my education mainly.
Right.
And then came on to the, worked at Old Dominion University taking care of their grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then came to the city 12 years ago, which, by the way, was the city that I most wanted to work at once I realized I was going to be in this career field for a long time.
You didn't want to go back to Zone 2 in Alaska?
No. Alaska is a gorgeous place.
Yes.
It is absolutely gorgeous place, but not to live, definitely to visit.
No, you have some much nicer winters in Virginia Beach.
Oh, and you're on the beach. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, we have the beach. Don't have the mountains.
Well,
we do.
You do. You just got to drive. You just got to drive to them. Yeah. So a few minutes ago on the first part of our show, we were talking with Fresh Kills and the park that's here in Staten Island. And as I was researching, so that was Carmen and I are both in Zone 7, right? This is our home zone, so to speak. So as I was looking, you know, at, I've always wanted to talk to somebody at Fresh Kills, and I want to go out and see it. And so I was looking at the Fresh Kills website, and I was looking at the idea of the trash and what New York City does with the trash. And New York City sends a lot of its trash to various places.
Yes.
One of which is the Tidewater area of Virginia, also in Zone 7. So then I started thinking, oh my gosh, so we are importing trash to another area, and you guys have the same successful, active park doing the same thing. So I thought that was kind of a strange tie-in.
Wow, that is really weird.
I mean,
it's not weird. It's just, it's...
Right. It's just plants are moving.
Funny how that,
Plants are moving, people are moving, trash is moving, right?
And potentially, I mean, I don't know what they're doing with the trash, but potentially there could be another Mount Trashmore,
well,
you know, 40, 50 years hence.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. Yeah, we have another one over in the City View area.
Oh, yeah?
And Centerville District. And there, I think there is definitely talk on that one becoming a park as well. It'll be a, I think it'll be two parks, actually, because it's quite large.
Uh-huh.
It's larger than Mount Trashmore.
Right.
And as our previous guest said, it takes like 3 or 4 decades to, from the time it's closed, to become usable.
Before it can.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be way after I'm long gone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I don't even know if I'm going to see Fresh Kills completed.
But this is the amazing thing, is that the plants make... The plants make this possible. Right?
Yes, yes.
The plants are always the constant thing, the cleaning, wonderful element that we have. So let's talk about some of the plants that are in your park and where they come from and what species does the best.
Okay, great. Because we, our team doesn't just take care of this park, it's not like we have these gardeners that are just roving around the city taking care of these gorgeous gardens. We have, you know, 175 miles of, or over that, of roadway. We have almost 300 parks, 82 schools, and then a host of a lot of other properties that we maintain for the city. So having said that, one of our new kind of sustainable approaches to landscaping, and we try to encourage that in everybody, is low maintenance, water-wise plants. It doesn't necessarily have to be native, but we love natives, and we'll use natives where appropriate. And that's basically our philosophy. So, and still try to make it aesthetically pleasing. I wanted Randy Wales is a landscape supervisor for the park and has been for quite some years. I wanted him to be here, but he's kind of shy, but I wanted to get his take on what his favorite plants are, because he's a scavenger of plants and has taught himself about horticulture. So So here are some of his. This is his list.
Great.
He likes compact butterfly bush. This was when he renovated the Waterwise garden, which was just a garden to highlight Waterwise plants. What happened there was the grasses pretty much took over, and grasses are great, mm-hmm. but he, you know, wanted to make it aesthetically pleasing, so they, him and his team worked on a butterfly garden design, and he added some compact butterfly bush, some native hibiscus. He really liked that for the beautiful flowers, and then
right.
the foliage and the cool seed pods. Mm-hmm. Lantana is another one of his favorites because he said it's a magnet for bees and butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Deciduous holly, he scavenged that from another garden that was being renovated, and he'll go out and dig everything up, you know, and take it back and find a spot for it. That's the way he is.
Uh-huh.
But and redbud trees.
Yeah.
So those are some of his favorites. And that garden itself, which started out as the Waterwise garden, is now kind of slash the butterfly garden. And we just got a call from a volunteer group who wants to, from one of the high schools, who wants to do a pollinator's garden, because that, of course, is a big ecotopic.
Right.
Everywhere in the world.
Yes. As it should be,
and
right.
making yeah. these spots for pollinators to stop in at is something that's really big right now at the schools in Virginia Beach, well, actually all over our area and probably the world. But
right.
anyway, so we'll be working with them to incorporate those into that catch-all garden, I guess, is, if you will.
Right. Mm-hmm. I noticed something that you said earlier in our conversation, Simsy, that the schools are included in your scope of work, right? So in...
Oh, yes.
So that's very interesting, because that's not the case
in New York City. No.
So the city of Virginia Beach takes care... The Parks and Recreation Department takes care of the land around the public schools?
Yes, exactly. It's Landscape Management Division
wow.
of Parks and Recreation.
Wow. That's so impressive.
It maintains the landscapes, the trees, the turf, the sports fields for schools.
Hmm.
And I'd say probably in the past 10 years, a really strong relationship between what is happening out in the environment and the students it's become a real important theme for teaching, for learning.
That's so great.
And so we're lucky enough to collaborate with schools to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And so that we do a lot of projects with the schools every year. It just, it's just increased, you know, like exploded. And we do butterfly gardens, pollination gardens, urban tree canopy projects. I'm working every year with different schools on tree canopy projects.
And I'm sure the kids come into Mount Trashmore Park a lot.
Oh, absolutely.
For projects.
I mean, it is
yeah.
The most visited park in Virginia Beach. And, mm-hmm. I mean, people know it nationwide. I mean, I'll
yeah.
hear visitors say, oh, hey, I heard about that Mount Trashmore.
Well, in the 70s, so. It was huge in the 70s. I remember the launch of it. And mm-hmm. I was up, you know, I was up in Arlington, which is
yeah.
2.5 hours, 3 hours, no, 5 hours difference depending on traffic.
Right.
I remember that. I mean, it was one of the biggest environmental public projects, I think, of the 70s. And it really set the tone and how progressive that Virginia was doing that, you know,
yeah.
and Virginia Beach.
Absolutely.
So
yes, and I think Virginia in general, just Virginia, steps out in that role to be at the forefront. And
mm-hmm.
that's why, you know, just thinking about, and I know people don't like to say this word, but water quality is really important. There's new regulations. Anything that we can do, and you're absolutely right, plants, trees, anything that's not gray cover, you know, we're talking green cover,
right,
is going to make a big difference in water quality and health and all that good stuff.
Well, and the fact that, just the physicality of Parks Department taking care of school land,
yeah,
you know, just is you're cultivating stewardship right at the exact level.
Yeah, absolutely. Stewardship is a big thing that we promote in our department and in our city.
Right.
The people in the city of Virginia Beach, the citizens, they let us know every 4 years there's a survey that goes out to the citizens, and the city wants to know what's important to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every time.
Can you imagine
every time,
New York City trying to do
because
that?
Because you know how funding is, we could get cut.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The citizens let city council and let our government know.
Yeah.
Environment, outdoor, and you know, nature is important to them
right.
in the city of Virginia Beach.
Right.
You know, it's one of the highest things. So,
well, and you guys have, I mean, you guys also, you know, you have some real serious storms that come through. So nature is a very big part of why people live at Virginia Beach.
Yes.
It's a very unique space. It's very fragile. It can be, you know.
And you get a big...
It can be with, you know, surrounded by water.
Right, right. And so, you know,
And you get the influx of tourists, right?
Right.
So the regular all-year-round population is, you know, there. Plus you have all the visitors.
Right.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, down at the... oceanfront and mainly, but
right.
Yeah.
But you know, that's why, you know, it's important to take care of your natural resources because it is your livelihood, you know, for the city of Virginia Beach. You know, if those beaches get washed away because they're not stabilized, and if, you know, Mount Trashmore isn't cared for, and if
right,
you know
right.
if all of our New York City garbage is just landing there, right?
Yeah,
and you know, it's wonderful. But so, another question I have: you mentioned lantana. Does lantana, is it hardy for you down there?
It can be. The Miss Huss can be if you. Kind of mulch it up. What we do, you know, just a little horticulture trick here, is we let it look really terrible all winter and keep its top instead of cutting it back really low when it goes brown after the first freeze.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of almost like a protection, and then cut it in the spring.
Oh, okay.
We still lose it, especially for some reason. We've, even though our zone, you know, we've gone up a couple zones over the years.
Yeah.
We've been having colder than usual winters, so, you know, more snow seems to, or maybe I just think that it lasts longer.
Right.
But, yeah. So.
I think the older we get, the longer it feels, right?
Winter does feel long.
And you know, and you've got a much nicer habitat than we do up here for winter, so.
Oh, yeah. I can't even complain, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in New York, it's no joke. We're talking, what, 3-4 feet, 5-6?
Up in New York State.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't get much snow because we're right on the water. But yeah.
And but New York is doing some awesome stuff with the environment,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the gardens that they're creating on roofs and along, you know,
the High Line.
What is that? The line,
High Line,
the rail line.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The High Line. Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. That's good stuff.
It is good. So tell us, what does the future hold for the park? What do you see for the next 25, 30 years?
Well, I talked to Randy, and I was really hoping that, you know, to get his take. And one of the things, and I was really happy to hear him say that, is he wants to plant more trees along the multi-use path. We've lost some trees over the years there, and we need to be better about replacing and keep, and you know, increasing the urban tree canopy. So we'll be working together this fall, actually this summer, and then planting in the fall. But we'll be looking at tree species and planting.
What kind of trees are you thinking about?
A couple of things that the Parks and Recreation Department works on, too, using their capital improvement money, and they're looking at shoreline stabilization, wetland bench planting, water quality testing, and just making sure they're improving on that, and then looking at different wildlife issues and restoration projects.
Right. What kind of trees are you guys thinking about?
We're thinking about, not quite sure, but I'm hoping to plant a couple of lacebark elms and also some black gums, which are native. I know the lacebarks are not, but they're a really good tree down here. Also, we've been testing and trialing the American elm species that is
That
less resistant, susceptible to the Dutch elm. So we're trying those out with good success so far, and we're trying not to overplant them in one place, you know, no monocultures, but we'd like to try a couple there because it Mount Trashmore, you know, a tree that's going to be here for 200 years would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think Thomas Jefferson would be very proud of your work.
Yeah. Ooh, tulip poplars, too. That's another great, awesome tree.
Right.
I think, yeah.
Right. Do you guys do any edible stuff on Mount Trashmore? In raised beds?
I'll be honest, we have a harder time with edibles here just because of the climate and the... we do at a couple of our historical homes, but there are a lot of maintenance. And
It is.
So
right.
The one edible I do like and I always recommend is pawpaw. And another one is serviceberry, which has some historical, back in the colonial day. So, and those are fairly native for us.
Right. Yeah, we use a lot of Amelanchier up
in New York City. Yeah.
The it's fruits, beautiful tree.
It is. It's beautiful, and
the
fruits
birds love it.
Yeah, yeah, people love it too.
And you can eat the berries yourself. Have you ever had one?
Yeah, I mean, I know people do. I've never tried one.
It's like a cross between a blueberry and a cranberry, but
we should make a pie.
Myra Shapiro has had tons of fruit on hers.
We should make some pie.
We're not we have cherry trees there, but I consider them an annual in this area. So we're trying to be sustainable and not use them unless it's one of those things, like it could be a tree buddy where the person that passed on really, really just wants that cherry tree, and then we you know,
of course,
but other than that,
no, say no more.
Yeah.
We have that conversation a lot.
Yeah.
So people are planning their vacations, and I'm sure a lot of people from the north are going to be heading down to Virginia Beach. So can you tell us a little bit about some events that are coming up this summer to that people can enjoy at at Mount Trashmore Park and also the surrounding area?
Absolutely. We do. Our biggest event, I would say, is the 4th of July event. And the fireworks there, that is, you know, one of the biggest events. Down at, of course, you know, not at Trashmore, but at the oceanfront, there is the Rock and Roll Marathon, and also the American Music Festival, and that's in September.
Nice.
That is a huge event for the city of Virginia Beach now. At Mount Trashmore, they have movie nights, and they have, there's always something going on at Mount Trashmore, and it's one of the only places that you can go, and it's any time, day or night, that that park is open, there are people there, and children, and adults walking, and hiking up the mountain, and flying kites, so,
yeah. It's great. All the photos that I saw just showed a really amazing space used by the people, you know, in lots of different ways. Skate parks, playgrounds, open areas. It's really a great resource. And we're so glad that you could join us today to talk about it. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, July 23rd, too, we have a Sunday run day. And there's going to be a 5K. All of the month of July for Parks and Recreation is... you know, Parks and Recreation Month. So we'll be having a lot of events in July. So check out the website and make sure come on down and look me up if you do.
Okay. And yeah, let us know if you're in New York. We would love to meet you and we could show you some great gardens.
Okay, absolutely.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Susie.
Take care.
So I think we need to go down to Virginia Beach.
I feel like I'm there already. I just don't want to walk outside.
Actually, today's a beautiful day, and we're going to get out of the studio in a minute. Thank you so much for listening to We Dig Plants. You know where to find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us, and we'll be back next month with a new show about Zone 6. Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.